I could get on a plane, I could fly to any city in the world with my laptop and continue to make a living for myself and my family. And then I could go to another city and another city and another city and another city, and ain't nobody gonna stop me. Nobody's gonna say, you gotta come home, Kevin. I'll come home when I want. That is the ultimate freedom. To go anywhere you want in the world and be able to continue to make a living and not need anybody's permission. That is an opportunity. Again, I'm talking about the gravity of this situation because I don't want anybody to miss the gravity of this situation. That no other human being in the entirety of human history has had that option available to them. And so does that help you put things in perspective? When you're saying, oh, I don't want to spend a little money on a paid ads funnel. Oh, I don't want to spend a little money on a membership community, a mastermind. I got to think more about this freebie thing. I just want it to be perfect, and I just got to work hard. Blah, 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 blah. All of that baggage, put it in perspective, because I do. Let me tell you, I've got plenty of baggage, plenty of baggage. But what I think about is my opportunity, not to be location independent, not to be schedule independent, not to be financially independent, because I already did that. That's not why I'm here. I did that with a different business. I did that with another thing. I didn't need this to do that. So why am I here? Why am I pushing through my baggage? Because when I look at that opportunity and I think to myself, I have what it takes to get other human beings that freedom. That's why I'm here. There are people depending on me. There are people who I can come into their life, and a year later, 18 months later, their life looks completely different. They went from somebody who hated waking up every day to achieving the ultimate freedom. I did that for somebody. I have the capacity to do that for lots more people. The world, like that section of the world, depends on me to deal with my shit and put stuff out into the world that's going to be helpful for people. It depends. Those people depend on my ability to execute. That's what I think about. That's what I circle it back to. I know I'm yelling. I know I'm like passionate about this stuff. The gravity of the situation calls for that. Because again, nobody has had your opportunity before, and nobody's had my opportunity before. We're in the same boat. I have the opportunity to lead human beings to like a legitimate form of freedom that's never been a potential. So I have to wake up and kill it. I have to wake up and not have baggage. And not have baggage, but not care about the baggage. To do it anyway, to do it in the face of the baggage, to kick the baggage to the curb and be like, I'll deal with you later. I've got things to do. I've got an impact to make.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks. I'm Brett, and if you're new, yeah, I'm the kind of guy who uses Michael McDonald as bumper music. This song, in fact, is called Sweet Freedom. It goes, well, with the title of today's show. I'm usually not so obvious with my bumper music choices, but you know, I woke up today, it's Monday, it's been raining here for like 48 hours in a row, it's dismal, it's dreary, and I said, what would fix this? The answer to that question is often the music of Michael McDonald. And honestly, I've been waiting like 9 years to slip this song into the show, longer even. I love this song as a child. I remember this song being new on the radio. And, you know, I would sing along. Of course, I didn't know the words. How could any child know the words to your average Michael McDonald song? But the radio would be on, it would be playing, and I'd be going, Just will be a total of the day. And my mom would pull the car over and have me get out. She would say, just meet me at the supermarket. But it is September. It's time for a new year of school, folks. A new season of television. And some good news, a new phase of the School Sucks project. I am back to work. And despite not a lot of content in July and August, you are just going to get pounded this month with shows. I'm pretty settled. I have a new studio that is like 80% done. I still have some lighting work and electrical work to do, but it was done enough to welcome my first guests yesterday, two filmmakers, for a marathon 4+ hour conversation that is going to be coming to you in parts, along with a lot of other stuff, over the course of the month of September. Also, coming up in about 5 weeks, I'm going to be leaving to go on the Contra Cruise with Tom Woods and Bob Murphy. It is not too late for you to join us. You can go to ContraCruise.com, learn more, and ask yourself, is a cruise right for me? Maybe. My guest today is Kevin Geary. I'm definitely happy to welcome Kevin back to the show. He has been a semi-frequent contributor to School Sucks since his first appearance back in August of 2014. Kevin and I did a production called Getting Unstuck from Procrastination and Domestication. The subject matter of that show actually factors into the conversation you are about to hear. Most of you are familiar with Kevin from his very successful diet, fitness, and health coaching site, Rebooted Body. He's been on the show several times to talk about those topics. He's also been here to talk about entrepreneurship, productivity, and the tools that he uses to achieve such levels of success. Today, we're going to be focusing in on lifestyle entrepreneurship and this opportunity that you heard about at the very beginning of the show. That clip, by the way, many of you are probably listening to that and saying, ooh, I can't wait to get to the part of the podcast where that happens, because that was fire. But that's actually not even from the show. That is from Kevin's podcast at his new site, sixfiguregrind.com, where he teaches people marketing, sales, and online lifestyle entrepreneurship that can bring about not just financial independence, but schedule and location independence as well. And those are wonderful things, trust me. At least I know a lot about the last two, still working on the first one. Maybe I did those things out of order. Kevin and I will discuss on the show today. So stay tuned. Many of you have asked for more shows about the entertainment industry, more shows about movies. I am about to fucking deliver on that, probably in three parts. Two professional filmmakers who have worked with A-list actors and actresses and directors on award-winning films were in this studio yesterday, and we go deep on the behind-the-scenes aspects of filmmaking. Normally, that type of content would be behind a paywall because it is outside of our core topics, which are the problems with school, alternative education solutions, personal development, and critical thinking and learning. Now, parts of that discussion will cross into several of those areas, but because production has been slow, I wanted to make this available to all of you. And I definitely want to say thank you to those of you who continued to support our efforts, even during that slowdown through July and August. It was really helpful. It was really encouraging. And if you enjoy what you hear today, please consider joining the supporting listeners. You can go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and see all of the options for helping us out. And I thought long and hard about this and made sure there was one that is right for you. Yeah, you. So that's it. Here's my conversation with Kevin Geary on lifestyle entrepreneurship. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. You will hear from me again very soon. Here we go. Kevin Geary, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brett.
It's My pleasure. There's so much we could talk about. It's been a while since you were on. People certainly know you've been on in the past to talk about health and fitness, productivity and organization, entrepreneurship, the 2016 election. That was a good 4 or 5 hours of our time one night. But today we're going to focus in on something very specific, a unique opportunity. I guess people from my age down to teenagers are the first people to realize pretty much in the history of the world the things that we can do today to achieve financial independence, lifestyle independence, schedule independence. And this is something that you've taken to teaching now with a new website that you have. It's new within the last year.
Yeah, I worked on it part-time, launched it back last summer, and recently, I would say in the last 90 days or so, I've gone all in on it.
Yes, indeed. It's called Six Figure Grind, where you're teaching people how to attain this financial independence for themselves. It pulls lessons from what I would say, as far as I know, is your biggest online business success, Rebooted Body. But there's probably numerous failures I've never heard of that people in my audience have never heard of. Is that correct?
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of them.
Going back to about when did you start?
2005, 2004, dabbling in stuff online. Plus, I've had many offline businesses as well.
Oh, so you were like a teen when you started this?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been an entrepreneur pretty much my entire life. It's all I've known. And like I said, it's been a mix of online and offline ventures.
Right. So what are you primarily trying to achieve with Six Figure Grind? And what are the means of achieving that?
So I feel like we have a unique opportunity. We're one of the first generations to have this ability with zero gatekeepers, with not much money at all, to build something on the internet. It's location independent, it's schedule independent. We can be financially independent through it. This idea of building an online lifestyle business. And to me, that's the ultimate freedom, in that in the past, when you didn't have the internet, when you didn't have this ability, I mean, you were always tied to a location for various reasons. Now that just simply doesn't exist. And I feel like not enough people are taking advantage of this opportunity. I show people how to take advantage of that opportunity because I feel like, look, this is what bigger impact could I have than leading other human beings into this opportunity that nobody's ever had before and getting them to what I feel is the ultimate freedom. So out of all of the projects that I've worked on, out of all of the businesses that I've done, I feel like this one has the potential to make the biggest impact in people's lives.
Indeed. Now, you've said on the show several times that you believe everybody is an entrepreneur. And that's not, you know, being like anybody can do it. You're saying that basic economic laws, everybody is behaving like an entrepreneur. What do you mean by that?
So, yeah, I think everybody should consider themselves an entrepreneur. We're all playing on the same economic playing field. We're all trying to convince other people to pay us for the value that we provide. And I recorded an episode on this because, I mean, you hear the phrase all the time, entrepreneurship is risky. And I couldn't be an entrepreneur. There's too much risk involved in that, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you look at what an employee is, an employee starts out, I mean, especially if you like go through the school system, you get a degree, all right, now I'm ready for the workforce, right? And you go out and you're basically, you are an entrepreneur at that point, and you are going to a company, clients, potential clients, prospects, and convincing them to do business with you, convincing them that you can provide them value and that they should pay for that value. And if you get hired, you have your client. The problem is, in that scenario, that's your only client. So yeah. You can't like go, you can't go get more companies, you know, like, cause they typically look down on that. So, you have married yourself to one client, and in the past, for sure, that was a very, very, very stable thing. In today's world, that's not so stable of a thing. The economic landscape is changing very rapidly, and the job that you have could disappear overnight. Your boss could decide one day that they just don't like you anymore. And so they fire you, and now you're unemployed. And now what are you? Well, you're back. You've been an entrepreneur this entire time. Like this myth of employee, being an employee is safe. I think that really needs to go at this point. Especially when we're talking about building an online lifestyle business where you're not paying for some exorbitant lease. You're not having to pay for a bunch of machinery. You're not having to pay for a bunch of inventory. There's not, like, for sure in the past, like building a brick and mortar business, a lot of risk involved in that because you got to borrow a lot of money in a lot of cases. The online thing, I mean, when you can take out a few $100s out of your bank account and you have a business, you know, there's not a lot of risk there. And if you want to build it on the side to mitigate risk even more, that's a potential as well. So in the age of the internet, there is no such thing as entrepreneurship is riskier than being an employee.
Indeed. And it's interesting that there's still this risk associated with entrepreneurship that you mentioned. It's frustrating for me as a former college consultant that what is a tolerable risk for an unfortunate majority of people is obtaining a four-year degree. Now, maybe if it's, you know, a master's degree, the risk goes down a little bit. Maybe if you get a doctorate, the risk goes down a little bit more. But getting a four-year degree, say, you know, going six figures into debt for that and then putting yourself out into the workforce or the potential workforce with, hundreds of thousands of other people who have that same piece of paper, that's not considered risky. That's considered normal. That's what you're supposed to do. And I think we've seen, you know, really in the last 20 years, this is what you're speaking to, there's kind of been a flip where for many people, and obviously it's major dependent, right? Like what did you get your degree in as far as the amount of risk you're going to incur? That's still not seen as risky when things have actually changed. And that's becoming more risky than having this independence in many ways for many people.
Yeah. And it's not just going into the debt. I mean, that's bad enough. And sure, we're talking about massive amounts of debt that's not bankruptible if you're doing the student loan thing. So yeah, for sure, that's huge risk. What about the 4 years, the 6 years that you spent not interacting with the marketplace in any way, right, shape, or form? So you've foregone like 4 to 6 years of something you could have built over that time that would be significant, that would be paying you lots of money, that would be an actual asset for you, gaining skills, learning how the market responds to your ideas and the things that you're trying to provide them in terms of value. All of that is lost.
At a time where you could also be taking probably greater risks. It's probably before you get married. It's probably before you have children. It's probably before you buy a house. You know, like age 18, when people are going off to college, that's like prime time to be in many ways adventurous. So you're losing that. You're losing earnings. You're losing experience. And you're going into a bubble, basically.
Absolutely. And there's one more angle that I want people to consider here. And it really plays out when you read the studies on who is satisfied with their job, who feels like they are making an impact in the world, who's really passionate about getting up and going into the office every day. Well, it turns out like 3/4 of the people aren't that. They're not passionate about their job. In fact, they don't like their job. They feel depressed a lot. There's a lot of stress. And I feel like the system creates that because when you're going through this 15,000-hour public education system, public school system, and then you get into quote unquote higher education, if you're taking student loans, if your parents have been, you know, pushing you along this entire time, you're doing what you're quote unquote supposed to do. I think a lot of people get, and keep in mind, very, very young at this point. You have no life experience whatsoever. You don't really know, I don't think, most people don't really know what they want to do to make an impact in the world. Right. They do what they think they're supposed to do at that point. And then they get into a position after all of this time and all of this effort and all of this money where they feel like they're committed. And in poker, they call it pot committed. Like, you've put so much in that you should just play it out at this point, right?
Right.
And so that's what they do. And then they get their degree, so they play it out. They get the job, they play it out. And then they find themselves in this situation where nothing is the way that they thought it was going to be. And there's where the depression comes in. There's where all the stress comes in. And they want to escape. And here I am saying, perfect. This is a perfect time to escape. If you want to escape, let's go, because I'll show you where you can go to.
How common do you think those revelations are about that need to escape? Because I would think when you consider all of those sunken costs, not just of money, but of time, energy, building experience with one employer, there are some real emotional blocks to taking an honest look at what's making a person unhappy. I mean, and of course, this isn't just limited to the world of employment. I think this could certainly happen in the entrepreneurial world as well, where people just, you know, bury all of this time and energy and emotion in one thing and they don't walk away from it because they don't want to admit to themselves that it's failing. But if we're just going to focus on people coming to you, Kevin, and saying, yeah, you know, I realized I'm really unhappy, I need a change, I need to move away from this and into what you're offering, how rare do you think that is?
I think it's pretty prevalent. I think that the amount of people who actually seek out more guidance and direction and take that possibility seriously is a lot fewer than the people who are sitting there in jobs not liking the way things are going. Like, they recognize that they don't like the direction that their life is headed. They don't like the career that they're in. But when they hear about somebody like me building an online lifestyle business and being location independent and schedule independent and financially independent, they have a very difficult time breaking the programming that they've been subjected to for all of this time that says that's super risky. Because they go back to, well, I've got health care, well, I'm paying my bills, I've got, and like you said, now at this point of their life, they've got a family in a lot of cases. So now it's like, yes, it does seem even more risky now because there's kids in the picture, there's a wife, there's a mortgage, there's this, there's that. And so they just kind of write it off, I think. They don't know, they don't realize how close they actually are to making a successful transition and how little risk has to be involved in making that transition. And so that's one of the messages that I want to put out there, is that it might feel really far away. It might feel really risky. Those are narratives that you've been told. When you actually start to put one foot in front of the other, moving towards this new opportunity, you start to see, oh, it's a lot closer than I realized, and it's a lot less risky getting there.
Okay, so one of the greatest challenges, one of the hardest ideas to break away from when you talk about people doing what they're supposed to do or what they feel like they're supposed to do, is letting go of this practice of trading time, usually in increments of hours, for money, usually in increments of dollars, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I have to share a personal story. I'm not proud of this. All right, so here's the backstory. And I'm really surprised I still went for this at this point in my life. But as many in the audience know, over the last couple of months, I've been moving part of the way across the country. Turned out to be a bigger deal than I originally anticipated. It took up a lot of my time last month. But since throughout July and August, I didn't do much work. So my output wasn't very high. And that hurt my bottom line. And it also cost me some people from like the supporting group on the show. I was also spending money at about twice the rate that I normally spend. So I was about 100% over budget July and August, making all of this happen. So here we are in September. I'm ready to get back to work. But I would have been ready to get back to work, I think, much sooner, at least a couple of weeks ago. And somebody dangled a bunch of money in front of me to do a side project, right? Mm-hmm. Which was entirely trading time for money. And I saw that amount of money. I saw that, you know, oh, my savings has been depleted. This would replenish it. And I said, yes. Somebody dangled this amount of money in front of me. And I said, yes. thinking it was a positive for me. But weeks later, I'm realizing the opportunity cost of doing that. By not being able to put out as much work, it's, you know, money that doesn't come in on Patreon. It's supporting members of the community that are unhappy and say, where did you go? And they cancel their memberships. So here I am, 5 years into doing this as my primary source of income and seeing the benefits of passive income, not just from this, but from some other things that I do. And when somebody dangles an attractive amount of money in front of me per hour, I say yes, right? Because and I don't know if there was some fear or nervousness associated with it about the amount of money I was spending versus the, you know, the money I wasn't making. But here I was in this situation, and I really thought that I had outgrown this idea. But there's many people who've never even had a taste of what's beyond that transaction.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I don't think it's wrong to take money in exchange for time. And there's certain situations where, look, if you're going through a move and you have spent more money than you wanted to or planned to, and you see money slipping away in this other area, a lot of times when you're spending time on an asset, it's not going to pay you right away. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a situation where you need money right away, you might have to trade some time for money.
It wasn't even that though, right? So what I identified as I was sitting, I was at this job that I was doing, right? Where there were these interesting moments where I was on the phone with the person I was working for, and I said, the words came out of my mouth, is it okay if I, and then something else. And I thought to myself, when was the last time I had to say that to anybody in any kind of, you know, money-making situation? So that was mildly frustrating. But then I was listening to your Six-Figure Grind podcast while I'm doing this, and you're talking about calculating the worth of your time. Now, this wasn't an emergency, you know, that led me to this work. It was a scarcity mindset, right? It was seeing savings depleted, recognizing that I wasn't making as much money as I normally do, and saying yes to something that actually had you know, I mean, I think it's still going to wind up on the plus side. But yeah, I get the idea of, well, you know, I should really be putting this time into things that are going to make me money a year from now. If you have a scarcity mindset, you're just not in the position to make that decision, I think. And that's how I found myself, you know, kind of falling prey to that.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. And, you know, with like 2/3 or something of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, a lot of people find themselves in that situation where it's like, gosh, how do I get out of this cycle? Because I need that money, right? And all I know how to do is work for that money. Like I just have to exchange my time. I have to use the skills that I have and get paid for that. And, you know, how do I get out of that cycle? And what I talked about in that podcast episode was to worry less about what you're doing right now, but to start putting yourself in the frame of mind of, no, I build value. I build assets. That's primarily what I do with my time. I get paid lots of money for that, and that's worth a lot. And so when I'm in situations where, and I came at it from the perspective of like, what are you doing with your time while telling yourself that you're actually saving a lot of money doing that? And I think I used the example of like mowing the lawn or changing your car's oil, where like people still tell me this all the time. I have friends that are like, yeah, why do you go get your oil changed? Pay somebody to do that. I change my own oil. I save like 50, 60 bucks. I'm like, how long does it take you? They're like, oh, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours. All right, well, my time's worth a lot more than that. And you've got to put yourself in that mindset that like that's a task for somebody else to do. That's not a task for me to do.
Let's dig into that, okay? How would you, Kevin Geary, calculate the worth of your time? With all these things that you have going on, what's the formula that you would use? Because obviously we recognize it's going to be very different for all kinds of people, right? Like if you have a proven track record in consulting on certain things, yeah, or you're a lawyer, your time is just going to be far more valuable maybe than somebody else's, right? It doesn't mean that person can't make their time more valuable, but as things are right now, what is there like a general formula that you would use for calculating the worth of your time?
So there's an exercise that I like to run people through, and I use the actual numbers in that podcast episode when I run through the exercise.
Figures.
But the basic exercise, and it's different for everybody because the first part of the exercise is you get to determine, like, all right, let's just step out of what you currently make and what you're currently paid. How much money do you want to make? How much money would you just love, right? Like, let's just take all of the barriers out of it. Just pick a number. And the whole point of this exercise is to show people, all right, if that's your number, then here's what that boils down to per hour. And I think in the podcast episode, it came out to somewhere around like $250 an hour. Mm-hmm. And then I use that number to say, now, what are all the tasks that you're doing where you are spending basically your own time? And let's now put yourself in the position of I'm worth $250 an hour. So like, oh, you cleaned your house for 4 hours? That's a really expensive adventure that you just went on around your house, right? If that's really what your time is worth. Because this is what wealthy people do. Wealthy people who know how much they're worth and know, you know, what activities to put their emotional energy in and their physical time and effort into, they prioritize that stuff. And they don't do this other stuff. They don't clean their house. They don't change their oil. And it's not because they're stuck up. It's not because they're just like, you know, greedy and they just like to do, like, they just like to make other people do this. They recognize that, no, that's not where, like, that's not my zone of, like, brilliance and genius and value. Like, somebody else needs to do that so that I can spend my time doing this really important thing over here. And so the way that you do that in a realistic fashion is, let's say you set this big number. Okay, now how many days a year are you going to work? Realistically, it ain't 365.
Right.
So figure out, like, take the weekends out, take the holidays out, because you don't want to be working on those days anyway. You don't want to be grinding every single day of your life. So take all of that stuff out. What number are you left with? It's like 200 and something days, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, now out of each one of those days, how many hours can you actually be productive building assets and making this like dream become a reality? It's not 8 hours. It's just not. So you can't calculate it based on that. It's like realistically 2, 3, 4 hours, something like that. A lot of your time's going to be wasted. A lot of your time's going to be distraction filled. There's just a lot of reasons why it ain't 8 hours. So if it's 2, 3 hours, now you have a realistic amount. So you multiply that hours by the days and you get your number. You divide it by the big number that you put in the very beginning. And now you're starting to figure out, if you want to actually hit that goal, here's what your time needs to be worth. And now you have to start making decisions. One of those decisions is, all right, everything that's below that, I got to start getting some other people to do that. Because now I've got to focus on the tasks that are actually going to generate that kind of revenue, that kind of income. And what are those tasks? And typically, it's not like, hey, you pay me and I'll do some work for 6 or 8 hours on this project. It's asset building stuff. And building an online lifestyle business is building an asset. You're not building a job where you're just going to have clients, and every time somebody buys something from you, that's like another 10 hours of your life gone. It's, they buy something from me, and then 1,000 more people buy something from me, and I don't have to do any extra work. That's an asset. And that's what the opposite model is, of not getting paid for every single hour, where I can go to bed, sale comes in, I made money, hey, it doesn't cost me any extra work, doesn't cost me any extra time. I already did that time.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting that you see a lot of people, even people who are finding really creative ways to make money online, they're still following that other formula, right? Like people make tons of money making YouTube videos, but mm-hmm. it requires basically having a platform that is in many ways your boss, and you are paid, you know, out of ads on these videos that you have to keep producing. A lot of payment platforms like Patreon work the same way. And I think that's actually one of the secret reasons why I love it so much and I'm so comfortable with it. Because I can like plan out, like if I do this, 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 and this, and this, I get this, right? So same bad habit, same scarcity mindset. Nothing against Patreon or supporting people on Patreon. I think it's a great thing. But there's a comfort level that I have with it for that very reason. So even in some of these newer endeavors, you see that same kind of habit or pattern taking place.
But that's still better.
I agree. It's way better.
Because let's look at that model, right? Where, yes, you do have to keep producing content or people are going to stop paying you. But look at someone like Jordan Peterson, right? Who's got like, I haven't checked this page. I don't even know. Did he get kicked off Patreon? I don't even know at this point. But it's not, at one point, he was getting a shitload of money, right? It's
like $60,000 a month. Yep.
Yeah. So do you think he was spending like that much more time than you on producing the content?
No.
Right. So he was even though, yes, if he stopped producing content, I'm pretty sure people would be like, hold on, what am I subscribing to on Patreon? Like, all right, they're going to pull their subscription, right? But that platform gives you the ability to do the same work. And instead of doing the same work for 100 people, he could do the same work for 100,000 people and mm-hmm. get paid an astronomically larger amount for not an astronomically larger amount of work. And
right.
So that is a really great step up. Even though, yes, there are problems because it's a third-party platform. He doesn't own Patreon. You don't own Patreon. If you're doing this on YouTube, you don't own YouTube. They can shut you down overnight. Big problems there. But it's still way better than just collecting a paycheck for hours worked.
Right. And the way you make that work is you build an audience. You build a bigger – which are these higher value activities that
right.
you're talking about that go on in the background that you can leverage towards that end.
Exactly. For sure.
Right. Instead of just producing more content for the same audience.
Right. Exactly. Because when you do the work to attract 100 people, right? Mm-hmm. Those 100 people are also paying you next month, right? So you had to produce content. And in a lot of cases, you had to, you know, like to get people to actually subscribe to you, there's other work that has to be done. Like you're not just pumping out podcasts, you're sending emails, you're being active on social media, you're doing a lot of like, you know, grinding kind of work to mm-hmm. to build an audience. But the thing is with something like a subscription model, you do the work, or maybe you're just paying for ads. In a lot of cases, you just pay for ads, get in front of people, they decide they like you, and then they join your tribe. They start paying you. Okay, so you did that work and you actually put a financial investment into getting that person. But once you've gotten them, you might have them for 6 months, a mm-hmm. year,
sure,
5 years. They're still paying you. You did the work 5 years ago. They're still paying you, right?
Right.
And yeah, you're still producing content. But if it's in alignment with something you love to do, you're making an impact in the world. I mean, that's what you should be doing. Like nobody wants to just sit on a beach and do nothing. Like that's really boring after a while. Like making an impact in the world and providing value to people, that's what people typically wake up for every single day. So the work that I'm talking about in a lot of cases is that it doesn't actually feel like work, and especially when it's not a direct time for money transaction.
Right. Now, there's other times, Kevin, where mm-hmm. it really feels like work, especially at the beginning, right? When you're starting something new and you're talking about some of these things that from the get-go, you don't – or I, let's be honest. I don't see how they're going to help me, right? So you've talked about the importance of doing things that are intimidating. Now, this has been your advice on this show since your first appearance in 2014, which was about breaking out of a comfort zone, right? Getting mm-hmm. Unstuck, I think, was the name of the podcast. It means getting uncomfortable, right?
Yep.
That very idea. So in episode 45 of Six Figure Grind podcast, you were talking about this, why you should do things that intimidate you. But people often won't do these things, and I often won't do these things, usually because of some form of baggage. Now, in this context, what does baggage mean?
Oh, man. So it depends on the person, but
sure.
There's a lot of, I think the best word for it in a lot of cases is just insecurity.
Right.
Right. So for example, there are people who have a brilliant idea for an online business, and they are terrified of any number of things. It could be a broad thing like, ooh, that's just so risky. Or it could be something, much more like hidden below the surface where they don't want to be a face of something. They don't want to be on camera. That's just so uncomfortable for them. Like, they don't want to have to like build a team or manage people at some point. And the good thing about the online lifestyle business thing is you don't have to build any sort of massive team. Like, yeah, there's probably going to be some people you want to enlist the help of. That's very important, right? But it's not like you're running a company like you would a startup or a brick and mortar or anything like that where you're the boss, you got to micromanage people. None of that stuff is really going to happen. But a lot of this stuff, you know, this is when I say baggage, insecurity and all of these fears and narratives and the stuff people tell themselves, stuff their parents have told them, stuff their teachers have told them. For it's different for everybody, but it's for sure it's there.
Indeed. Now, you obviously, through this podcast, through the work you do on the site, and I think a lot of people in my audience knew about it before you started Six Figure Grind, you look pretty comfortable and very competent doing this kind of work. But you've talked about having your own baggage. So two questions. First of all, what does that mean for you? And then I'd also like to hear, just maybe the last question rephrased, what are the most frequent obstacles you encounter with clients? And that's also a bit of a self-serving question because I'm just curious to see if other people are having some of the same problems. But let's start with you. When you talk about baggage that could get in your way, what does that mean?
So for me, and it's something that I struggled with, not so much anymore, just because I've been doing this for so long. But I remember when I first got started, especially with like the Rebooted Body podcast. I remember the first few episodes that I put out. First of all, if you go back and you find that podcast and you listen to episode number one, the very first guest that I had on kind of alludes to the insecurity, right? The very first guest that I had on was my friend, right? It wasn't like an expert that I was going to interview because I did a bunch of expert interviews on that podcast, right? Mm-hmm. It was just a friend. Like I wanted a very easy first episode conversation in the books because I didn't really trust myself. Like I didn't have a lot of confidence in myself, my message, what I was actually about to try and build. I didn't know if anybody cared. I didn't know why people would want to listen to me, even though I had a compelling story. And this, a lot of people struggle with this, right? It's just imposter syndrome. You just feel like you don't really belong. Why are you here? Like, why are you trying to do this? Why are you putting yourself out there? That's the baggage and the voices that you run into over and over and over again, especially if it's your first thing. Now, the more you do it and the more you realize like, oh, the world doesn't really work like the way you fear it works. You kind of like get over that, but it's really strong in the beginning, especially if you look at these other influencers. I still have people and I have clients right now where I will send them. So they have their niche chosen. They have their topic, like all the stuff they want to build, their vision is all laid out. And I'll send them a link to somebody who is doing something like they want to do already. And that's good, actually. Like you need to make sure that you have competition. If you don't have competition, that's a big red flag. So mm-hmm. I'll send them and I'll ask them to start to like, all right, look, here is somebody who's already doing what you want to do. They're very, very successful. I want you to start dissecting what they're doing. And the first thing they come back to me with is like, I'll never be like them. Look how beautiful their site is. I don't know the first thing about building a site, right? Look at how many programs they have. I can't even imagine like even having one program at this point. And so they look at where somebody is and they go like, I can't be that. So I shouldn't do this at all. And it's really a crazy kind of way to think about stuff, because then what I do is I go to the Wayback Machine. I don't know. Have you ever heard of the Wayback Machine?
Oh, I've been there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you can basically put in a URL on for anything on the web. And the Wayback Machine just basically takes screenshots of sites like over and over and over and over again. And so it'll show you what any site looked like at any other point in time.
Right.
And so I'll Wayback Machine the same site and I'll show them and I'll go, their site looked like trash when they started. They had no, you can see the content, you can see everything. They had no idea what they were doing when they started. They were exactly where you are at. And right. So that kind of shatters that for them. And they realize, oh, like that person just pop out of nowhere, like as magic, and like they have everything that they have. They really started from having zero clue what they were doing. And if you surround yourself with the right people, you surround yourself with the right resources, then you're going to be able to get there too. Because there is a process. There is a formula to doing this in a successful manner. It's not random. It's not guess and check. If you do it on your own, it is random. It is guess and check. It is fail a lot and figure it out. And sure. It's very time consuming and it's very risky at that point. It's very frustrating. But if you follow the formula and you surround yourself with the right people and the right resources, then your chance of success goes through the roof.
Indeed. As far as like maybe checking in on somebody who's a little bit further along, that seems to be one of the things that would in a newer person generate this feeling of I don't belong here or I'm an imposter.
Yes.
Did you ever feel that way in the health and fitness space? Because I think for people who don't know that story, it's really interesting. Like, you had let yourself go. We told this story, I think, the first time you were on the show 4 years ago. You were overweight. You had some health problems. You discovered some things, and it was a lot of work, and you turned your life around. And then I think people in your real life started asking you about it, and you made it into a product because you thought it could help other people.
Yep.
Right? That's it in a nutshell.
Yep.
Did you feel – was there any fear like, well, geez, what if I slip back to that, you know? I mean, you started Rebooted Body when all of that had happened like within the last 2 or 3 years, right?
Yep.
So when you first started to do this, you know, did you feel that way? And what was that like and how did you overcome that?
Yeah. So for sure you fear like, all right, well, like if I lose control of my eating again, right? Like let's say I gain a whole bunch of weight, I would become like maybe a fraud at that point. Like my whole business might dissolve. And what kind of, I just spoke a minute ago to like the world doesn't work the way that you fear that it works.
Right.
When I interact with dozens, hundreds of other health coaches, experts, gurus. I'd go to conferences, Paleo FX. I'd see all these people that have really popular podcasts, really huge email lists, sites with tons and tons and tons of traffic. I would see them behind the scenes. A lot of them are really fucked up people.
Like, sure. Oh, yeah.
They've got mad amount of pride. And they don't – it's like you listen to their podcast. You look at their social media feed. It's all, of course, all like very expertly curated. So you never really see – and then there's a lot of like fake authenticity. That's really popular right now. Like let me show a bad side of myself or whatever, quote unquote. Put that out there so I can be authentic and get a lot of people to clap for me for being authentic. Trust me, that even that is curated, right? Mm-hmm. It's safe enough for them to share. That's what they find. They find vulnerabilities that are safe enough to share. And then they get a bunch of people who, you know, applaud for substanceless shit all the time to clap for them. And that builds their brand even bigger. But if you really like talk to these people behind the scenes and saw their life, they would sign up for my program. Like these are other health coaches all the time would sign up for like Decode Your Cravings. Because, and they would tell me like, I'm still struggling with like just being around food, like I'm neurotic, et cetera, you know? So would they tell their people that they were doing that? I don't think so. So you start to see like, all right, well, you know, yes, it's possible that, and now I did a whole bunch of work. The whole point of Rebooted Body, the reason why it got so much traction, the reason why it helped so many people is because it wasn't just fitness and nutrition. It focused on the psychology of like the lifestyle change. It focused on the why do you crave certain foods at certain times? Why do you feel out of control around food? It got really deep into that side of things. And when you unlock that and food loses its power over you, the risk of just like going back to the way things were is nil. So at one point, like it just, or at some point, it just stopped being a concern. But yeah, in the very beginning, you do have that fear because your family is relying on this business. And mm-hmm. if you screw up in some way, then you could lose it all. And it would be super unfortunate. But, you know, it didn't happen. So again, fear not actually matching reality.
Right. So let's just finish up with baggage. I've heard you say on the show that it doesn't show up as like complete inaction, but it often shows up as procrastination, right? Mm-hmm. Which is something that I certainly identified with. And, you know, is that a pretty back to the common themes of clients, whatever information you can give there is helpful. Overcoming procrastination, how common is that in your work?
Yeah. So in the health and fitness side of things, what that looks like is people, it's not like procrastination is a tough word to use to describe it. But like, cause it manifests itself in different ways, but people that jump from diet to diet and plan to plan, they don't give it enough time. They're just looking for a quick fix. They feel like, well, I'm doing the work. Like I'm actually committing to these things and I'm not getting results. And it's like, but you're not. Like you don't really commit to anything. You pseudo commit and then you ditch it and you pseudo commit to something else. And you tell yourself that you're investing in yourself. You tell yourself that you're doing all of these things. You tell yourself that you're enlisting the help of others, but you're really not. It's really just a big story, a big, you know, thing that you're making out of all of this. And on the business side of things, it's like, all right, sitting around mapping out a course. And it's like, all right, when does that mapping out the course? When does the brainstorming? When does the outlining? When does the content creation? When does all that stuff actually end? Because for the procrastinators, for the people who are operating from a place of insecurity, it never really ends. It just keeps going. The planning keeps going. The brainstorming keeps going. Nothing actually ever makes its way into the world. And that's when I see that happening in clients, I go right to the insecurity thing. And it's like, no. Why haven't you put this out into the world yet? That's where we need to get to. Because if you didn't have the insecurity, it would already be in the hands of people. You'd already be making money from it. You'd already be getting feedback on it. You'd already be pivoting. And like one of the episodes that I just released very recently was about needing to move faster. You have to move faster. And this can actually be the antidote to that, I think. Like,
right.
If you know that, look, this is the, like, here's my timeline. I've got to get it out. I've got to get it in the hands of people. And you stop worrying about what the reaction is going to be. You only worry about how fast can I get this thing out?
Right. So we're actually going to finish up with that because I think if people are interested, this would be a really good introduction to what you're offering at Six Figure Grind. But man, that really hits me. And people will say things to me. People say this to me, you know, fairly regularly, like, wow, you get a lot done. And that blows my mind that people think that. I've got an Evernote that has something called upcoming projects in it. There's like 100 things in there. You and I talk weekly. You know how many things that I've contemplated or started and haven't done or haven't finished. So when I heard this on the show, I was like, yeah, in a lot of ways, that's me. It's nice that I get some things done And that's brought a considerable amount of freedom, and it's created all kinds of opportunities that when I first started looking for work like what I do now, like in communications, like talking to people into microphones out of college 20 years ago, I never could have dreamed that I'd be doing this or having these opportunities. But I see it as like less than 10% of what it could be. And, you know, if I had to put a label to that failure, it would be procrastination. It's not like there's been any shortage of ideas. It's not like there's been any shortage of drawing up plans. You know, I had in one room, Kevin, at one point, I had like 100 square feet of dry erase space. You know, there's this great stuff you can buy. It's like a wallpaper, dry erase board. I covered a room with it once and wrote all over it. And I think it wound up getting thrown away with stuff written all over it, stuff that didn't get done. So, yeah, I mean, the procrastination has been a significant hindrance for me in the work that I've tried to do, and realizing that it's only a fraction of what it could be for that very reason.
So do you map your procrastination to any specific insecurities? Because let's use your situation as an example.
Sure.
When we see somebody who's totally insecure, they put nothing out into the world. They're always working on something, right? They're always busy, but they never actually put anything out into the world. That's not you, right? So you put a lot of stuff out into the world. And that's why you get responses like, man, you do so much stuff, right? And so people don't see your Evernote. They don't see the whiteboard. So what is the difference between the stuff you actually put out into the world and the stuff that's never made it out into the world?
I think it's like instant gratification. That's really what I think it comes down to. Like when that stuff goes out, it's not even about making money, right? It's not even like I put out a podcast and like envelopes start showing up in the mail with checks or dollars in them. It's just like this is a thing that's done. This is a thing that's complete. We were talking privately, you know, a bunch of us within the last few months. And I was saying like, you know what, this summer I might like to just, you know, go back to like the summer work I was doing when I was a teacher where I would paint houses because I get to be outside. And, you know, there's this sense of completion at the end of every day. And just like, you know, the morning starts and there's this much done and you go to bed and there's this much done and that feels good. There's something satisfying about that for me, but it's not knowing how these smaller pieces or these longer range but higher leverage things could pay off is absolutely paralyzing in a lot of cases. When I've spent most of my life, you know, doing work where there was a starting point and an end point, and a podcast or making a video entirely replicates that process in a way that is sometimes incredibly satisfying for me. So it seems like when I am working, and for the last couple months, I haven't really been, but when I am doing a lot of work, it's on these very immediate kinds of things that I know the enjoyment of a finished product is nearby.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. And you know, this is why it's important to have people to have these conversations with, to bounce stuff off of people, because I know that a lot of the stuff that you've planned on, and like, so yeah, let's map that to like the live events that you were doing. That's pretty immediate stuff, right?
Indeed.
You plan the live event, you get paid for it, you show up for the live event, it's done, it's in the books, everybody feels great, right?
Yeah, open and shut. Right.
Yeah,
it's
so we can
finite.
See why you executed on that. And put, even though that was for most people, I think that would be something that really steps on a bunch of their insecurities. Right. And makes them terrified of like, I'm going to organize a live event and I'm going to bring all these people to a city and I'm going to be responsible for how all of this goes. And I've got to, you know, be like the face of this and be a host. And like that can terrify so many people. A lot of people would never even touch that with a 10-foot pole. Right. So you did that though, and you put that out into the world. But yes, we see that it maps to what you just said. It was something that you could plan, you could execute, you could feel good about just being done with, right?
Yeah, it's finite.
And then
it has a shape, right? It has a form.
Right. And then we look at something like, because I know you've been kicking around the idea of like an online course for a long time, right? And that's an example of something that hasn't been put out yet. And so I'm wondering if, because the process that I use for online courses, for a lot of the products that I create, there are immediate, like I get to plan it, I get to work it, I get to put it out there. Just I would look at your podcast as, you could look at it either way. You could look at it as grand project, right? That actually never finishes. That's just always ongoing. It's open. Each episode is something that's planned and then executed on and then put out, and you can check the box next to it. And you can do the same thing with a course where, like the last course that I created, I sold the concept. I planned it. I sold the concept, and then I created the first module. When the first module was done, put it out there. Check the box, right? Then I went to the next one, planned it, execute on it, put it out there, check the box. And then I just built it piece by piece like that. And yes, because I did it wrong in the very beginning. And most people do it wrong where they brainstorm and then they're like, they come up with this great idea and then they build the whole thing and they spend months working on this big thing. And then they put it out finally, if they get beyond the insecurity thing, they put it out there and then it like flops because number one, they just brainstormed and built what they thought people wanted. They never actually asked anybody. They never actually did any validation steps, right? But it's better to build piece by piece. It's better to pre-sell it. It's better to get people's feedback, get it in the hands of people as fast as possible. And then you just pivot. And then you put the next version out. And then you get more feedback. And you add some stuff or you change some stuff. And then boom, you put it out there. You check the box again. And you just keep doing that piece by piece. And it becomes exactly like what you do with your podcast.
Sure.
Except you have an asset. Like obviously the podcast is an asset, but the course is a direct sale asset that has tons of potential for scale.
Indeed. And what happened in place, I think, of a lot of what you're talking about is a kind of counterfeit productivity, right? Well, I was producing on the kind of production that makes me comfortable, right? I was thinking bigger because we were talking about all this stuff. So I did surveys. I ran focus groups, right, where I brought four or five people together and we met for 90 minutes. And then I quantified the authentic input that I got from those people, you know, as quantifiable as I could make it. And then like it was even more ready to go with one of these ideas, and it just never happened, right? For that very same reason, is that from that point it was still like new and formless. And there's another part of it that's like darker and less comfortable. And I wonder if you encounter this kind of mindset problem as well. There's been a couple of times in my life when I was working in education, so-called, not as a teacher, but as a tutor. And I'd be in the car and I'd be driving like away from an appointment, or I'd be in line at the bank getting ready to deposit a check. And I would actually say to myself, I can't believe how much people are paying me to do this. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't believe that what I was doing, like, it's not up to me, I know, to decide the value that something has for somebody else.
Right.
But I was deciding that in my head, and I think in ways that can be really really unhealthy and really costly in other types of endeavors. Like maybe it was just a passing thought while I was depositing a paycheck that I thought was too big for the amount of effort that it took to earn it, finger quotes. But I realized that if that kind of noise is going on in the back of a person's head, like, I'm not worth this.
Right.
You know, that is going to be a major stumbling block that some people might never get over. Like, I'm slowly getting over it. This is slowly going in the right direction. But, you know, your most recent episode, Money Likes Speed, it's definitely not that, right? It's gradually pitching in a positive way. but what it could be compared to that, it can be frustrating to think about sometimes.
Well, I think this is one of the most prevalent things. If you took 100 people and you had them all design an online course based on something they're passionate about, something that they're proficient in, I like if you do my Freedom Plan Masterclass, that's one of the key parts of finding your big idea. It's mapping the overlap between a passion, a proficiency, and of course, profitability. And I show you how to validate all of that, right? But if you had somebody build, if you had 100 people build courses on stuff that they were passionate about, proficient in, there's obvious value there for other people. And then you sat them all down and you said, all right, put a price on the course. What are people going to pay to go through your course? 99 out of 100 of those people, I would be willing to bet, would grossly underprice their course. And why is that? I think everybody is insecure with anybody who has not made a lot of money in a little bit of time is uncomfortable asking for lots of money, is right. uncomfortable believing that they have enough value in what they are providing the world to bring in large amounts of money. And I think it's just a natural part in a lot of ways of like, for example, when I was 15, what was my first job? It was bagging groceries, right? Mm-hmm. It was minimum wage. Went to the pharmacy, had to go through some training. Actually, before the pharmacy, I became the clerk who actually, you know, punches the buttons. I think that was an upgrade, right? I got like a 50 cents an hour more. And then they shipped me off to the pharmacy because there was an opening there. And I was like, man, that sounds like fun. Go through a little training course. Now you're making $2-3 an hour more than you were. But all you're really doing is, you know, filling prescriptions and bagging them up and ringing people out, right? And you start to like learn over time, or you could learn over time, like, all right, well, like at this point in my life, this is what I'm worth. Like I'm worth $9 an hour. And here's what I have to do to get that $9 an hour. And I just had this conversation with one of my 250K students. So I run the 250K Society's membership community for online lifestyle entrepreneurs. And she basically said the same thing that you just said. Her exact phrase was along the lines of, I don't actually like the value that I provide people doesn't take me much time at all. So she runs, she does Facebook ads. She has a Facebook ads agency, right? Mm-hmm. So people pay her lots of money. And the work that she does to create the ads, put them up, you know, schedule them, get the ad sets going, all of that, she says takes her a very little amount of time. And she was very uncomfortable with the amount she was being paid for the time that she was spending actually creating the ads. And so we had to have the conversation of it has nothing to do with the amount of time it takes you. It has to do with the value you provide. How much are the businesses that you're working with making from the ads that you're running? And I explained this in an article I wrote on Six Figure Grind called Value-Based Pricing, where you price based on your value. That's how pricing should work. It shouldn't be based on time, shouldn't be based on anything else. It's based on the value you provide. If I do the same work for a company and they're going to take that work that I do and they're going to make $10 million, best believe I'm not charging them $1,000, right? If I charge them $1 million, they're going to 10x what they spent on me, right? Mm-hmm. And when I start getting paid that much money, what I'm actually worth based on the value that I create for others, it's actually a benefit to those clients. Why? Because when I have a lot of money, number one, I'm not desperate and I'm not taking on a bunch of other clients that I shouldn't be working with that are actually going to be a distraction from doing the work for this big client that I'm supposed to be providing a lot of value for. I have the money that I need to invest in the right tools. I'm not going to have to call them up and be like, sorry, my computer shit the bed and I can't finish the project on time. Like, no, that's not a problem. I have a team that I can enlist the help of because I'm charging what I'm actually worth. We can get the job done faster. It can be a higher quality job. It can be more consistent. There's a lot of reasons why it benefits the consumer to pay more for something. I think I did an episode on, there were like three things when I went on vacation that I wish I could have paid more for because it would have made a better experience. The experience sucked because they were undercharging, right? And that happens all the time. You go to a budget provider and you're going to run into a lot of problems. You go to somebody who charges what they're actually worth. It's typically a really, really good experience. Right. So we have to get, it's just a mindset flip of, no, I can provide value. I see the value that I can provide. And there is a learning curve to this in a little, like in a way, because if this is the first time you've done something, like, well, you have no proof yet. So maybe you, maybe under, and I tell people all the time, look, you're probably going to underprice yourself in the beginning, but that's fine. It doesn't matter. What matters is that you're actually putting it out into the world. What matters is that you're not procrastinating. What matters is that you're pushing through your insecurity. Sure, you get underpaid for a little while. That's fine. Get the results, use the results to then tell yourself, not other people, to tell yourself first, ooh, I'm worth a lot more than what I'm charging. Because if you don't believe that, you're not going to be able to go get it from somebody else.
Well, see, it's very contextual too. And I think this speaks to that, the opportunity of this time that we open the show with, right? Like there are millions and millions and millions of people in this country who would not value my time or maybe even your time at more than $15 an hour. Mm-hmm. Like, what could you do for me, Kevin or Brett, that I would think is worth more than $15 of my money per hour? That's the abundance of people. But there's thousands and thousands and thousands of people who we could both do things for that would be worth hundreds of dollars an hour or more,
right?
And we actually have a way to find those people now very easily. Like 50 years ago, you and I would have had to join secret societies to get access to those kinds of opportunities, to get into those networks, to make those kinds of connections. They're just, it's like projecting yourself outward today and you can find them without any of that weird stuff.
Absolutely.
Right.
And part of the process, if you're following the formula that I map out for people, it's when you find a niche and you find even more specificity within a niche, and you develop a secret sauce to bring into that niche with you, you become very, very valuable to people. And I use the example of somebody who wants to be a parenting coach. And so you talked a lot about parenting on this podcast. So I think it's a great example to use. People are going to understand how this starts to come together, especially in terms of a strategy, right? Of doing this in a very step-by-step way. So you could decide, all right, well, I'm passionate about parenting. I'm going to be a parenting coach. And then people are like, so you meet somebody on the street. The person's like, hey, what do you do? Oh, I'm a parenting coach. Okay. What's that mean? What do you do? Like, what kind of parenting? Because now we're into the realm of like, well, there's 300,000 different parenting styles. Like, mm-hmm. What kind of style are you? I don't even know. Like, what are you going to do for me? So they still don't know. And if you tell somebody what you do and they still don't know, then you got more work to do. You haven't done your job yet, right? So you dig a little bit deeper and you determine, oh, you know what? I have this like specialty where I know a lot about kids with ADHD. Maybe you've had a past job or position, or maybe that's what you went to school for. We go back to the passion aligns with proficiency. Okay. Maybe this is just you. It's just an example. Okay. So you say, all right, well, now I can get more specific. I can be a parenting coach for parents who have kids with ADHD. That makes me a little bit more valuable. You know why? Because there's not as many of those, right? So if somebody has a kid who has ADHD, now there's a smaller pool that I'm in trying to compete. But then I take it even one step further. You have conversations with people. This is part of the process. I'm very big on people, before they do any work, going into the niche and having lots and lots of very specific conversations. I give them the exact questions that they need to ask people. And so in the example, we determine through these conversations a couple things. Number one is that apparently there aren't a lot of resources on ADHD for girls. And apparently, ADHD shows up differently in girls. And so there has to be a different approach, et cetera, right? And a lot of it goes undiagnosed. And so in the example, it was like people telling this person, there's so many resources for boys with ADHD. There's not enough resources for girls with ADHD. I can't find hardly any, right? So there's an opening. There's an angle. So this person says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take what I already know about ADHD in children. I am going to become the expert on ADHD in girls. And then the other thing that they discovered through these conversations was that parents of kids with ADHD apparently were, and again, this is all hypothetical, were tired of hearing that their kid had a problem, right? Had a thing that needed to be solved. They wanted to figure out, no, how do I take this thing and channel it into something positive, sure, right? So then this got into like working on what their actual hook would be. And so anyway, they get to the point where instead of walking up to somebody on the street and going, hey, I'm a parenting coach, they were like, look, I am a parenting coach for people who have daughters with ADHD, and I help them turn their daughter's ADHD into a superpower. That's what I do, right? And right. So that is very, very, very specific. And that gives you lots and lots of benefits because, number one, that's a completely different message from what most of the quote-unquote experts are putting out into the world, right? It gets people's attention right off the bat. And then you know where to find these people. Like people who have daughters hang out in certain places. People that have sons might hang out in other places, different places. You know exactly where to go to find the people who have daughters. And when you, you know, find someone who has a daughter with ADHD, typically they know other people, right? That have ADHD, daughters with ADHD, because they go into these communities to get support. Right? Sure. They're in online communities. They're in offline communities. So guess what? Now they can easily connect you to other people. And if you actually are great at what you do, you provide an amazing value, it's a word of mouth bonfire. Because when somebody actually finds this thing that they already told you they couldn't find before, remember the people, there's a lot of overlap in people saying so many resources for boys, there's not enough resources for girls. They actually find you and you provide an immense amount of value, they will shout about you from the rooftops. They will tell everybody they know about you because they found the solution that nobody else has been able to find, right? Instead of just saying, hey, I'm a parenting coach. Okay, great. There's a gazillion of those. Good luck, right? Like, right. So you see how this becomes a very specific process, and that creates an immense amount of value. If you're the only expert on parents who have daughters with ADHD and you don't see that as a problem, but you help them turn that into a superpower. Hey, there's only one of you. There's only a couple of you. And we know from just looking at professional sports, why do they get paid so much? Because there's not many of them. That's why, right?
Exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, I've had this conversation with myself several times about, you know, I mean, and this voice was louder years ago. I think when I first started to explore this as a primary source of income because of the amount of time it was taking back in 2013, 2014. Along the way, when I got frustrated, I said, well, you know, maybe I should just go back to what I was doing. Maybe I should just go back to being a tutor. And in that defeat, missing the opportunity that in that world, I am one of thousands of people, mm-hmm. right? And I'm good and I can show people like, scores that I achieved based on like, you know, PSAT scores versus final SAT scores. And maybe that helps. And maybe I'm likable and maybe I'm competent, but I'm still just in a sea of other people who are doing that. Yeah. I'm the only person who ever created this other thing, right? I'm the only guy in the world who ever did this, right? So there's much more of an opportunity there for me than in that other world, even if the short-term gains often look more attractive.
Yeah.
And I think that's like, that's what you're talking about with, you know, I am this person who's able to say this about turning a young girl's ADHD into a superpower. It basically comes down to I'm the person in the world who does this thing, you yes. know, if you're looking, because you've niched down to that.
Exactly. Exactly. And in terms of your thing, using School Sucks Project as an example, I think, would you consider or would you say that in a lot of ways that you were ahead of the curve, like a pioneer almost in putting out this message that, hey, school sucks. It's not a great institution, and we should be looking for alternatives.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so in the class that I teach, I talk a lot about the dangers of being a pioneer. Now, you've been able to really make it work, but for everybody listening and for you as well, the way I look at it as if you continue to do what you're doing, because you are still, how many years has it been?
9+.
So 9+, I still think you're considered like in the pioneer stage. And the reason I say that is because the general public, I think if I have these conversations online all the time, now maybe the internet is different than the rest of the real world, but the most of the people that I run into still believe in the public school system, right? Would you agree with that?
Indeed.
Yeah. And so they are still looking at alternatives as like, nah, that's the odd thing. That's the we don't need to be going there. The world needs a public education. So, yeah. We all know the narrative, right?
Right.
There is going to be a tipping point where that narrative starts to crumble. And when that narrative starts to crumble, people who have positioned themselves in the way that you have will at that point skyrocket, right? They will flock to you. And so that's still going to happen, right? So if you look at the scale that you're at now, you're nowhere near the ceiling in terms of potential for where the project can go. It's just a matter of when is that tipping point going to occur. And we see this a lot in other industries where once the first few bricks start to crumble, the rest of it comes down pretty quickly, right? And so you are in position, perfectly in position, because you've chosen this niche and you've chosen to be specific in the way that you have. And so you're going to be the go-to when that institution starts to actually crumble. And if you're not niched down and you're not specific and you haven't been able to get to authority status within that niche, because if you just say I'm a parenting coach, good luck becoming an authority in the parenting coach niche, right?
Yeah.
Because there's just so many of them. But when you niche down and you get specific, I mean, if there's not a lot of people doing the girls with ADHD, turning that into a superpower thing, it ain't that long before you're like the person, right? You're the authority, right? And so when it starts to get mainstream that, wow, girls have ADHD too. Wow, a lot of it's going undiagnosed. Now the tipping point has happened. People start to go online searching. Who's going to come up? Ooh, you. And you're the one everybody now comes to. And you don't have to go out and find work. And you don't have to say, oh, I'm X per hour. No. It's a completely different situation. And now you start to see the power, the value of building an actual asset and not just, doing one-to-one, hey, I'm going to work for you for this amount of hours. You pay me this amount of money. And I'm just going to do that rodeo for my entire life.
Indeed. And that positioning, again, it comes back to being aware of what that baggage is that gets in the way and having a strategy to move beyond it. Because some of the best advice that I got came from your podcast, and it also something similar came from Ben Settle, right? You said, if you let this get you, you're missing out on an opportunity to make an impact in a lot of people's lives, right? So that's part of what drives you with what you're doing with Six Figure Grind. Mm-hmm. It's certainly part of what drives me with this. Ben Settle said, if you feel like you have something valuable, you have a duty to yourself to tell people about it, right? Mm-hmm. And that can take all different types of forms, and it can involve all different types of difficult work to tell people about it. But those two things, those were really, really impactful for me. And I think when I get frustrated or complacent, hearing that stuff is really motivating.
Yeah, for sure. And, I want to give one last example just so people can really like see a clear distinction between placing my time in something that pays me per hour versus building an asset. Mm-hmm. Because there's a guy that I don't know his name. I don't know the website, but I was just hearing about his story on another podcast. He basically teaches people how to play piano, right? And so let's say that you're amazing at piano. And so what you do, what most people do, are like, ooh, I'm going to give people piano lessons. And so they put that out there. You know, they hang up their flyers or they make a website or whatever. And then people start coming to them and they give piano lessons. And like, how much is a piano lesson? Oh, it's $50 per hour. Okay, good. How many lessons would you want? All right, give me the check. Then I go do the lessons. I spend all that time. I go find another person versus this guy who went and built courses on learning how to play piano. So he put his time, instead of putting his time in the hourly mode of working one-on-one with people, he chose to put his time into building a saleable asset. And he built these courses, and he's making $30,000 a month. How many piano lessons would you have to do to make 30? You can't. There isn't enough time in the day. You would never be able to get people to pay you the rate that you would need to be paid to make that kind of money. He chose, instead of putting his stuff into hourly formats, he chose to build something that he can sell at scale, and he gets rewarded for it. And the end result, well, I was going to say the end result is the same. He's teaching piano, but the end result is not the same, because right, instead of making an impact in 10 people's lives, he's making an impact in thousands of people's lives. And so you get rewarded in other ways besides money as well. But that's a clear, I think, example. They can see the distinction.
It'd be about, by the going rates for piano lessons, as far as last I knew, it'd be a piano lesson an hour, but for the entire month.
Yeah. And at what point would you go, I fucking hate the piano and I never want to see another piano in my life?
Right. Right. Right.
You'd be having nightmares of your students playing.
No, you wouldn't. You'd be awake doing piano lessons.
You would not be sleeping. Yes.
So I wanted to talk just for a minute, Kevin, before we wrap up, about the one-page freedom plan. There's a great story that goes with it as far as the creation of it. It was on the podcast. The name of the episode right now, it's the most recent episode. It's called Money Like Speed. We talked about some of the themes from that. But people should listen to that to hear the backstory, because there's a really, really valuable lesson in the creation of the one-page freedom plan. But can we just talk about what it is and how people can get it? Because I think it's a great introduction to what you're doing at Six Figure Grind.
Yeah, for sure. So I alluded to the fact that there's a formula for doing all of this. And I'm not going to say the right way. I'm just going to say a way that I've proven to be successful, right? And so I got the idea for the one-page business plan basically sitting around asking myself the question, how do I get more people involved in online business? Because I have the 250K Society, which is my premium membership community, but you can't be in the 250K Society if you don't have an online lifestyle business. So it doesn't do me any good to have a bunch of people who want to have online lifestyle businesses just sitting around twiddling their thumbs. So I was like, all right, I've got to find a way to give somebody something tangible that shows them step by step. And I don't want them to have to pay for it. I just want them to do it. And so I created I basically said, look, can I outline a business plan that would fit on a single page? Because I've been in groups and everybody talks about, hey, did you do a business plan? No, I don't do business plan. They suck. You know, it's just a waste of time. But people really want to have a plan, and you actually need a plan, but you should not do a traditional business plan. Because yes, they are a waste of time. It's a bunch of projections. It's a bunch of fantasies. It's a bunch of guesses. It doesn't lead you down the right path. And then after it's complete, you basically file it in a drawer somewhere and you never see it again. And that's not what I wanted to create for people. I wanted to create something extremely actionable that leads them down the right path. And so I started mapping it out and I realized, hey, this is actually going to fit on one page. Amazing. Okay. So perfect, because it's not something that's overwhelming for people. Once you get it filled out too, the way I designed it, you can basically slap it on the wall. And you know, one of the problems that a lot of people have running their online business, because they don't have a boss and they don't have like somebody telling them what to do every single day, is they come to me and they're like, I don't know what to do today. Like, what do I do? What is that like profitable behavior that I should be focused on? Well, the one-page freedom plan has all your profitable behaviors on it. So literally you go to the one-page freedom plan and it tells you, here are the things that you should be working on today. Here are the things you should always be focused on. So it's actually like a lighthouse, like it guides you every single day of building your business as well. It's not just a planning thing, but it's an action thing. And so I created it, and I created a class to go along with it, because unfortunately, all of the instructions and the context and all of that can't also fit on
exactly
the front page, right?
Yeah.
So I created the class. The class is free as well. So you go to sixfiguregrind.com. It's on the homepage. There's also a link in the navigation for the one-page freedom plan. You download the plan. You enroll in the class. You can watch it on demand. Everything is free. After you watch the class, you'll know exactly what you need to do to fill out the one-page freedom plan correctly. And then it's up to you. You've got to execute on it. And if you're serious about this and you're serious about achieving the ultimate freedom, which is kind of the concept we started with, then you need to do the work at that point. And if there's an insecurity issue or there's any other kinds of issues, reach out. Reach out for help. But that is the thing that will get you started. You have one page of paper in your hand that tells you everything you need to do.
That's awesome. And I took, I think, was the SEO course the first one that you did for Six Figure Grind?
That was the first course, yes. And then there was an email list building course. All of my courses, though, have been taken off the site, and they are only available now to 250K Society members. So everything is going into the 250K Society.
I gotcha. But you've definitely been building trust with this audience for a long time. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. It's always a really valuable and motivating conversation. So thank you so much, Kevin.
Yep. Thank you for having me.